France was very, very heavily involved in financing the American War of Independence against Britain. And then France, of course, would be at war with Britain above and beyond that. These commitments really did place an enormous burden on the French budget. And they led in 1787 to renewed attempts to revise the tax structure. The proposals for reform were rejected by the Parlements, and in 1788, Louis XVI reluctantly, very, very reluctantly, felt compelled to convene the Estates General of France. They had been convened last in 1614. So this was hardly a vital institution, hardly one would have to check the historical records to find out what procedures would be for such an institution. The pressure on Louis XVI to convene the Estates General came not from the middle strata of French society, nor from the peasantry, but rather from the aristocracy and the clergy. They had taken the first step, pressuring the crown to convene the Estates General after all of these years, believing, of course, that they would dominate the proceedings of the Estates General. The clergy was the first estate, the aristocracy the second estate, everyone else was the third estate. And so whatever influence this third estate might claim for itself or might have, its actions could always be blocked by cooperation between the first two estates. Louis XVI allowed elections to be held. They were held all over France with a surprisingly wide suffrage, broad franchise, to elect at a regional level representatives to an intermediary body, and then they would then elect people to the Estates General. Louis actually hoped that a radical third estate would sober the clergy and the aristocracy and make them more pliable. If the third estate convened and made all sorts of demands based on sort of Enlightenment philosophy, et cetera, he hoped that this would so frighten the first two estates that they would then swing in behind monarchy, realize that some reform was necessary, and therefore Louis might be able to resuscitate the French state. Some reform-minded aristocrats and ecclesiastical persons were, in fact, chosen in the elections to those two estates. So those two bodies were not simply very conservative or reactionary bodies at all. There were some that were quite reform-minded who were elected. But the third estate. The third estate certainly lived up to Louis's idea of a radical body. It was dominated by men of really the most radical orientation possible at that time. Lawyers and professionals and civil servants, but mostly of low social rank. Men who certainly understood the political implications of Enlightenment thought. Men who participated in the provincial salons, the reading organizations, political societies, and who had generously imbibed Enlightenment ideas. And they were ready, willing, and very, very eager to apply those ideas. In the summer of 1789, then, a crucial conjuncture of interests had occurred. The clergy, the aristocracy, the members of the Third Estate were united in their opposition to the crown, and in their belief that the reforms that Louis wanted to achieve had to be blocked and some other alternative found. That unity of opposition to the crown obscured some very real differences within what might be called the revolutionary coalition. Differences in interests, differences in points of view about reform, about the nature of the state and the economy. Still, when the delegates convened on May 1st, 1789 at Versailles, they were determined to bring about change. But what kind of change? To what extent change? Revolutions, and I think that is, if one tries to visualize the social coalitions that are necessary for all revolutions, I think it's instructive to envision an hourglass with sand pouring through the hourglass. around the rim at the top, filled with sand. You have people, you have different orientations, all coming from different points of view. But at a crucial conjuncture, they're narrowed into that centerpiece of the hourglass. That's when the revolution occurs, when all from this broad base of ideas and social groups, you have this conjuncture. Successful revolutions tend to extend that period of conjuncture for a relatively long time. Frequently, however, what happens is that the sand passes through the center of the hourglass and then disperses. The key for revolutionary coalitions is to find the formula to hold it together. That struggle to find such a formula and the attempts on the part of the monarchy to prevent it, we'll talk about in our next lecture.